Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Eerie Encounters, Volume 5, Story Number 1. This is incredible due to the fact that I was in California visiting my family. I went to a local bar to hang out with like 7 friends I had grown up with. Well, we come out of the bar late and walk across the street to a parking lot behind the business there. So suddenly this young kid, maybe 10, runs up to us and is petrified and says, "That guy over there, he's trying to pull my pants off. And it's midnight. And what is this kid doing out here?" So I turned and walked closer to the building and bam, I'm knocked out flat from behind. Now at that time, I'm 6'5", 240 pounds or so. And I'm not the biggest of my friends. We were the football players back in the day. I immediately got back up and all my friends are hauling ass into a bicycle store that the guy that hit me owns. He's way heavy but shorter. And as I ran in the back behind my friends, this guy is running around to get away from us. And being intoxicated, my friends and I just literally destroyed the store. Wrenches from the workbench are being used to destroy all the glass cases in the store. We're ripping expensive bikes from hangers and jumping in down on the wheels and even bending some frames. This guy is screaming and being chased, and I mean, we wrecked that store completely in our rage. So, we head out to the back and tell the kid to come with us, and we plan to go back in the bar while somebody stayed with the kid. Someone called the cops and they show up as we're coming out of the bar, and the kid tells them that that guy, what he'd done, and they go into the shattered business and come out with his guy in cuffs. So come by, the cops say, "By the way, what happened in there?" Because one of the huge picture windows to the front is broken on the street and all the glasses everywhere inside from the cases, etc. And the rest, that guy went wild when we came over and punched me and then went on a rampage wrecking his store. I'll never forget. They turn to the kid and say, "Is that true?" And the kid says, "Yes, sir." They wanted to know if assault charges would be filed, and I said no. I've been in a lot of fights and been hit hard a few times, so it's fine. I just know they knew we did it, but he's going in for molesting a kid, so they let it go. And as the one cop walks the guy past us, I just reached out behind the cop and kicked the legs out from under the perp, and he face plants perfectly when the cop lets go and he's cuffed. The cop whips around and I'm 5 feet away, and he looks at me and said, "I saw him trip. Gosh, that was some wild stuff, but I don't know what happened to that dude. But the witnesses, as in us, said he wrecked his own place. So I don't know if he got any insurance for it, but the cops just left the place wide open and just left with him. We didn't bother grabbing anything or go back in, but yeah, sometimes them pervs get caught. In other words, they get caught with what's coming to them." Next story. My sister and I hiked all over our favorite mountain area, not always the same spot. This time we had gone the opposite way of our usual trail that led up from the road. This opposite way took us on a one-lane road over a rushing stream at the bottom of a ravine, and sadly, past ravines on either side of this road that had been used up by people and in areas an illegal dump. Years later, it was all cleaned out by volunteers. It ended near a small area of cultivated fields that was posted against trespassing. There was also large machinery, including a bulldozer, parked along the edge of it. Because of the no trespass signs, we were careful to avoid the cultivated area and machinery and to stay on a deer trail that began at the bottom of the hill and led up into the hills. It was a beautiful area, lots of wildflowers and a wonderful little mountain mahogany tree where we encountered a brilliantly colored black-chinned hummingbird. We watched the gorgeous little bird for a while and then went higher. To our surprise, we found ourselves near a huge concrete power pole up there in the wild. From where we were surprised to see that A, the line of power poles led off over the hill far into the distance, and B, beginning about a half mile or so from us, many of them were lying down and the power lines were on or near the ground. My sister asked if I thought it was safe to continue. Now, I was always taught to assume that any power line that is drooping or down is live, and to stay away from it. So my answer was no, I did not think it was safe and we should go back. And that's what we did. Late in the week, I was at my job for a large retail chain. Now, my job wasn't sales related, so it was rare for me to be out on the sales floor. For some reason that day, though, I had gone up to the front of the store near the front doors and cash registers. Suddenly, and without warning, a young man came running at me, grabbed me, and swung me all around. I was stunned and mortified until I realized who he was. Dan, not his real name, a guy I hadn't seen since junior high. It had been at least 15 years since I had seen him, and he told me again and again how delighted he was to see me. He also told me that he recently seen another girl who'd been part of the small group of us who were allowed by the librarian to hang out in the tiny library at lunch every day, and how thrilled he was about it. He was radiant with happiness and hugged me again before he walked out the doors, and he was gone. Fast forward a few weeks. To my utter horror, I saw in one of the local small-town newspapers a tragic story. This young man and his girlfriend had been hiking in the hills above the town. I realized from the description that that had been the exact area my sister and I had been. But they kept going. Dan had reached out to lift one of the power lines so that his girlfriend could walk under it and was instantly electrocuted and killed by the live wire. His girlfriend was so unhinged that she stumbled down out of the hills a good mile or more to the road and was in such a state that she didn't dare get into the car because she believed she'd die too. She continued to stumble down the road until she thankfully encountered some people who summoned medical help for her and proper authorities to recover Dan's body. I was left to wonder, was he being given the chance to say goodbye to all the people who had mattered to him before he was slated to leave this existence? I don't know. At least that's how I felt. Next story. I used to have this happen to me quite frequently, mostly in my teenage years. It would be after school or after work, all at times where people would be coming home. My stepdad would work side jobs after work and would stop home in between or would run inside real quick and do something before working in the attached garage. The weird thing is that I would never hear the garage door opener, just the opening and slamming of the door to the garage. I would ask my stepdad, and he would just look confused. My mom just played it off like he was messing with me. My mom actually had a great false arrival encounter. She lived in what was a finished attic in my grandparents and their old Chicago house. My grandfather and his brother-in-law finished it, complete with a living room, a bedroom with two beds, and a small full bath. My mom was in the bathroom putting on makeup and thought she was home alone. She heard the door close, movement up the stairs, and shuffling in the room. My mom assumed it was her sister she shared the room with and proceeded to have a conversation while getting ready to go out. She even saw movement in her peripheral vision. As she left the bathroom, she was all alone and nothing had been touched. The creepy part is that the sister she was talking to called after my mom cleared the upstairs. Now, there is a few ghost stories about that attic, though. And let me share a story that happened. Now, that same grandfather who finished up the attic also built a small lake house. It's a public lake with maybe 15 houses around it. We only know two families that live on the lake. The last time I was up there was pretty sketchy. I stumbled upon a meth lab in the woods and had a few weird run-ins with this creepy guy when I would go into town. It was me, my now wife, my mom, 11-year-old brother, my mom's cousin, and her two teenage kids. We enjoyed our last night with a small fire in the lake and Dutch oven grilled cheese. We packed it up and put out the fire around maybe 10 or 11 p.m., We went inside due to the swarm of mosquitoes that haunt the North Woods in that time of year. Anybody who has been to the UP after the 4th and before Labor Days knows exactly what I'm talking about. We all went up to the second floor around 11 p.m. to go to bed. All of us just kind of lying there in the dark, telling stories about my grandfather. Out of nowhere, this blinding light hits the back wall of the cabin. The light was coming from the mile-and-a-half-long drive we have. It didn't seem like headlights or a light bar because there was no buildup or distortion from it moving through the narrow path. It just appeared out of thin air. Was it aliens? Some angry meth heads? The creepy DNR guy? The police checking out the fire? The layout of the house is not at all ideal for the situation. There's only one window on the top floor facing the drive. There's a sliding glass door facing the lake opposite the light source and a thick metal door on the side of the house. I couldn't see anything out of the upstairs window. Nobody was in front of the house by the lake. I did a brief search to find where Grandpa hid his goodies. 1911 and a 308. Of course, they were hidden really well, and I wasn't about to turn on all the lights and rummage through the house. After about 5 minutes, the lights just disappeared. There was no noise, just bright light. I asked my neighbors about it, and they saw it through the trees. Nobody knew what it was. Funny story, I went there about 2 years after the incident, and the creepy DNR guy showed up on my property. He saw me crack a beer on my anchored pontoon boat and started chewing me out. I have no idea how he saw me in the middle of the lake. Didn't even ask to see my fishing license or lack thereof. Next story. Several years ago, up on the main lane, there's this old widow lady who was found dead in her little home. Natural causes. She had lived there for as long as I can remember. Used to see her from time to time crossing the road to her mailbox. Anyway, after her passing, they demolished the little house, and the section of land just remains there. The mailbox and post are still there also. Last summer, I was on my way home from work on the motorcycle. Beautiful summer day. As I was getting closer to where the mailbox sits, I noticed what I think is a mist cloud crossing the road. I slowed down, but didn't stop because as I got closer, it just disappeared. As I rode past that mailbox, I got the most intense smell of sweet perfume. It was just a hint, really, but intense. I kind of smiled to myself and thought of that tiny old lady. Told the wife about it, and she said she could have been her. She reminded me how the older women used to love to wear really sweet-smelling perfume. Never really thought about it again until last Monday. I was driving home in the truck due to its cold. As I got to about the same spot, I again noticed this mist-looking cloud cross the road. I had the window down about halfway and the heater on. As I passed the mailbox again, I smelled what I think is the same perfume. It doesn't freak me out or nothing. We have strange things happen around our house all the time, so I'm a bit used to strange things. It just makes me curious about why. Yes, I believe in ghosts. I think that sometimes a soul just gets stuck where they were when they passed. Next story. I was a park ranger in eastern Kentucky in the mid-70s. I recalled coming up upon an unusual-looking pile of rocks while on boat patrol. The water was unusually low, so the pile had likely been underwater for many years. Piling a rock would have been difficult at best because of mud and silt. The last time the land had been completely dry was prior to impoundment in the 40s. Even then, it would have been a good bit of work. Historically, low water exposed a number of features, including a small cemetery that had been overlooked during creation of the lake. We were kept busy that summer trying to prevent pot hunting and grave robbery. Robbers dug into 20th century graves looking for ornate coffin hardware. Pot hunting was a much more common occurrence and more financially rewarding. On one patrol, I saw what appeared to be disturbed soil near the top of a bluff. I climbed up only to discover that what appeared to be signs of digging from my boat was accumulated droppings from a vulture roost on an overhead ledge. Fortunately, I was alone and didn't need to explain my mistake to anyone else. Heavy rain that fall put archaeological sites right back underwater. Next story. Last year, a group of guys are regularly go on overlanding trips with went on a trip with a plan to start in Belmont, Nevada, and then travel east determining our route as we went. This approach is nothing new to us, and as a norm, we are fully prepared for what may come. Fuel, water, food, communications, etc. However, plans rapidly deteriorated on us and were forced to go back and backtrack and ultimately abandon them. I'll skip all the details that put us in the position, but it boiled down to a lost member that was planning on joining us and some tagalongs that talked us out of a needed fuel stop. From this point on, there's two stops before the weird experience that may or may not be pertinent depending on who you're talking to, or they could be considered of utmost importance. To me, they're probably just more coincidental than anything. Stop 1. We stopped for some lunch in Tonopah, Nevada, and chose to eat at the Mizpah Hotel. A little background here. If you're from anywhere in the region, you know the Mizpah. It was built in the early 1900s, and up until the 20s, it was the tallest building in Nevada, which says a lot about what this place was back then, especially considering that now Tonopah is nothing more than a fuel stop for those passing through. It has also been shut down for many, many years. Our visit marked about a year of it being reopened to the public. There is history of several people losing their lives in this hotel. The most famous of them is the Lady in Red. She was a lady of the night, supposedly murdered by her significant other for being a prostitute, murdered out of jealous rage. Along with some gold miners and some kids, this place is ripe. One of my good friends is dramatically fearful of things that go bump in the night, so I thought it would be a good hoot to try to get a surprise tour of the place. So under the guise of using the bathroom, I went and talked with the front desk, and sure enough, she was more than willing to give us one. It was very cool to see the inner working of the hotel, but watching my buddy squirm was even better. All but him were hoping for something cool, but nothing odd happened, unfortunately. Stop two was in Goldfield, Nevada. Do a little research on Goldfield and you'll find some amazing history. It was a boom town that produced, even by today's standards, a lot of gold. I mean, a lot. In Goldfield standards, the Goldfield Hotel, closed to the public, but we stopped to look in the windows and take some pictures. This place is supposedly one of the big paranormal hotspots in the West. As a matter of fact, ghost hunters came here and filmed two episodes. From a 1 degree separation experience, I have two friends that had some very weird experiences happen there personally. Access to this place is super limited, and anyone would be lucky to enter. Additionally, everyone that has ever tried to renovate this building and reopen it has lost all his or her money doing so. It seems there's energy working against that goal. While we were there, this odd couple stopped and started walking around the building as well. But we noticed that they were more than just looking at the building. Let me back up a sec. By odd, I mean, he looked like a slime ball used car salesman, and she had this weird voodoo looking vibe about her. Let me put it this way. If I met her somewhere else and was asked without hearing her talk where I thought she was from, I would have guessed the shadow areas of New Orleans. Like I said, so they were more than just looking. We noticed her walking around with her hand in a plastic bag, picking up specific pieces of rubble, the same manner someone would pick up dog feces, as to not touch it with your actual fingers. We were like, what the hell? In a whisper, of course. By the time we left, they were dismissed from my brain until we ran across them further down the highway, entering an abandoned brothel, which we did think was very strange. This brings me to my actual story. Like I said, the two above stops may or may not be associated, but I thought they were worth mentioning. We ended up at an old miner's trail east of Beatty, Nevada. Beatty would never typically be listed on stops because of how close it is to the Nellis Air Force Range, but because of our new trajectory, we thought we would at least explore what we could. It was getting late into the afternoon. By the time the trail started, it was already getting to enter dusk. We drove further back into the desert until well after dark, looking for an acceptable place to make camp. The road was a grueling, very rough, untraveled rock mess, and we were spent. We finally found an entrance to a canyon that had been mined at one point. The attraction to this spot was a semi-leveled area that we could make camp. I was by myself, while M and K, my buddies, had their boys with them. Because of this, I chose not to set up a tent and just make a pallet in the back of my 4Runner so I could watch the boys, make a fire and prepare dinner, which were s'mores cause we promised the boys, and just wanted to go to bed. The vibe here was unlike any place we've ever camped, and the night before we had tents directly in front of an abandoned mine shaft with no weirdness. Here, though, there was just a tenseness about it. I found myself scanning the seeable area and constantly looking over my shoulder from having heard something, which in most cases isn't odd, it's just nature. Here it was different. I can't explain it much differently. Despite my feelings, we continued to set up. As M was done and sitting with me by the fire, noticed that he was constantly scanning. K is our paranoid buddy. M and I aren't. So I asked, I need to know what you're looking for. His response was playing dumb, which I immediately told him, I know you're not being straight, because I'm looking at the same thing. Essentially, the source of the tension. I kid you not. Within a breath, we hear this loud roar, similar to a train in the distance coming from the canyon behind us. And within seconds, it was like the train passed us by, blowing over everything not weighed down. We had both never experienced anything like that, and after it passed, it was calm again. However, the tension was much higher. There was a point I racked my weapon. I did it in such a way that I didn't want to raise the tension, but once I did, K and M's weird meters started to peak because I would be the last to respond to an area with no real perceivable danger like that. This is when I went to each of them individually, as they were both busy, and asked them what their thoughts were. Kay says, "You mean the bad mojo I'm trying to ignore?" "Yep," I added, with alluding to a strong sense of being watched, hence racking my sidearm. We decided it was best to pack up and leave. Within moments of this decision, the train came back through, this time knocking stuff into the fire and taking them yards away from camp. It took minutes to break camp, which would typically take 40 to 60 minutes. However, in the meantime, it seemed as if right outside of the light, hidden in the shadows all around us, was something letting us know we needed to go, but causing issues that wouldn't allow us to leave as quickly as we wanted. As if to say, "I didn't want you to come, but now that you're here, I'm not letting you just leave." M's son would literally camp every day of his life. He loves it so much. So he's regularly asking when we're going next, and he was one of the first to ask if we could leave. Not one of us there could tell you what happened, and words fail to describe the activity of our third eye. Words can't convey the sensation of your heart dropping out of your chest as you turn to something that isn't there. Words cannot paint a clear enough picture of physically feeling like you're just standing in the windstream of a train passing by that wasn't there. We told this story to M's dad shortly after it happened, and he'd asked if we ever heard of the Rhyolite ghost train, and that he thought it sounded like the case. It happens to have run within miles of where we were at on the other side of the highway. Kay thinks there could have been a trifecta of energy taken from the other two locations to create the environment of what happened. M and I have no clue, except that what happened was far from ordinary concerning our experiences in the desert, and that each previous event funneled us to where we were that night. Next story. When I was in my early 20s, I liked camping alone, sometimes just for an overnighter. I lived in Tasmania for a year at about that time too. So there's a great walk at the southernmost tip of Tasmania at Southeast Cape. It starts at Cockle Creek, and the first part is well maintained. Runs through some of the most amazing bush you'll find in Australia. A peat bog, a creek, some rainforest. I used to do that, walk a lot. So one night I'm lying in my comfy bed where I lived in a brick apartment in Hobart, the capital of Tasmania, and I started thinking about a ravine I'd noticed on one of my walks running up from the peat bog between two hills, and it looked quite beautifully heavily wooded. And I thought that maybe I should climb up the ravine and camp over on the other side of the hills somewhere. I could see it quite clearly in my mind's eye, as clear as if I were there. In my mind's eye, I followed the ravine over the hills where I wanted to camp. Now, I had never seen what was over the hill. This was all just my imagination, based on what I knew the terrain in the area was like. And I imagined a spot there in a tiny clearing beside a huge tall tree and my little dome tent set up and me camping there that night. And then I felt like I was being watched. And it freaked me out. I wasn't there. I knew I wasn't there. I was lying in bed at home, thinking, imagining what it would be like to camp there. But I felt exactly like people sometimes describe. I couldn't shake it. The more I thought about it, the more fear I felt. I had goosebumps. The thing is that there are no large predators in Australia, and even less in Tasmania. No dingoes or foxes. So I've never been afraid of bears, cougars, wolves, or anything like that. Also, I'm over 6 feet and built like a barrel. I could see this little clearing so clearly in my mind, and I felt like there was something dangerous there, something like a big predator, and it was going to pounce. Anyway, I stopped thinking about it, and it took half an hour before I could shake it off and fall asleep. Needless to say, I never did do that camping trip. I find it really interesting that you don't have to be there to get that feeling. I don't even know if this little clearing really exists or not, but the feeling was real, and my body's response to it was real. I have to admit that when I did walk alone, I would feel eyes at times on me, but from far away, and that I was fine as long as I stayed on the track. I would usually come across another 2 to 6 people in groups of 2 on that track, so I suppose I felt safe because it was well used. I felt this once since, but then not so strongly. This was on the mainland and the bush, and most of Australia is so open that you can see for hundreds of yards around you. But there was a place that I felt something watching me once, but not that it was going to try and attack me. All it was doing was watching. Next story. In 2016, a friend, this happened to him while camping at the Stillwater Tent and Trailer Park in West Pigeon, Ontario, in Thunder Bay. He woke up in the middle of the night to what he said were two grays. He couldn't move or scream, and the last thing he remembered was a sharp pain just above the clavicle next to the neck. When he came out of the tent in the morning, one of his fishing friends was alarmed at blood, which was on his t-shirt and on his shoulder. When they inspected his sleeping bag, they found more blood. They took him to the provincial hospital, where one of the doctors said that something had punctured his skin and went alongside the muscle at about 2.5 centimeters. The hole was about 2 millimeters and scabbed, and an x-ray showed something the size of a 1206 surface mount resistor was at the bottom of the puncture. He elected to wait and have it removed back in the States. It took 2 days to get back to Indiana, and then another day for him to see the doctor, which confirmed the object was there. They decided to remove it 2 days later in an outpatient procedure at Parkview in Fort Wayne. The morning of the procedure, he woke to find more blood on his sheets and pillow and went to a 10:45 a.m. appointment. When the doctor did a scan to confirm location of the piece for removal, it was no longer there. It was in tissue at a location where it could not have moved by itself. And the doctor noted that the penetration into the body showed trauma, as if something had been put in him again, which disturbed the tissue, which was in the process of healing. Yet the skin penetration at the surface showed recent scarring, which one would expect of a wound 3 months old. Ron now sleeps with a proximity alarm and an IR alarm, which has gone off once since the event. Since then, he now sleeps with a revolver on the nightstand. Since 2016, he's never had another problem, but in 2017, he had a full scan of the upper torso, which confirmed no foreign material in his body. And since that event, he will only go fishing with the guys if they are all in the same tent together. Next story. Well, after Katrina, I spent a year working with FEMA, working law enforcement in Hancock County, Mississippi, Ground Zero. I was assigned to patrol the so-called buffer zone around Stennis Space Center, 218 square miles of woods and swamps, no buildings allowed. Back in the early 60s, they took the land, closed and bulldozed 5 towns, but NASA maintains 9 cemeteries scattered through there. The idea was when they lit off the Saturn V boosters, if it blew, there would be no civilians. I had a 4-wheel drive and, of course, the night shift. Now, 218 square miles doesn't sound huge, but there are no lights. I'm the only person, supposedly, to be out there, and it's dark. Being only about 40 miles from New Orleans, it's an ideal for dumping stolen cars. At least once a week, I'd find one burning. My take was, since I'd seen no one in those little roads, those little burners, they were just out there watching my happy butt stopping to call fire. New Orleans is also home to voodoo, and those 9 graveyards dating back to the early 1800s were prime. I had to eyeball each one twice a night, one way in, one way out, and I'm out there by my lonesome, finding black, white, and red candles melted into some 150-year-old tombstone, and the wax was still warm. Talk about feeling eyes on you. 200-year-old live oaks drooping with Spanish moss, and knowing there were multiple freaks watching me. For all I know, they wanted to cook me or some such. After I finished my contract, was getting ready to leave, the shift lieutenant told me I was the only zone deputy who stayed a full year and continued to patrol. I didn't know they had GPS on my truck, and they watched these other guys go chicken shit and log patrols that didn't occur. I'm too dedicated to let zombies scare me if what I told about them is true. I begun getting out with so many firearms, walking was a challenge. Strange place out there, and glad my contract finally was over. Next story. It was 30 minutes past legal sunset. Darkness descended into the hardwoods, filling the valleys first, then topping the ridge. The golden hour had come and gone, and I hadn't seen a single deer that evening. I was 13, and it was my first season hunting alone. Up until this point, I had always been with my father or an older sibling. I stood up from the blowdown I had been sitting on. cleared my firearm, a Marlin 30-30, put it on safe and slung it over my shoulder, prepping for the half-mile walk back to our camp set up on the next ridge. I had a 200-yard walk through the forest down the ridge I was on to an old logging road at the base of the next ridge. From there, just follow the road up the hill to our camp on top of the ridge. I remember the first part of the walk being uneventful. I made it down the hill with no problem. Cedar trees choked both sides of the logging road, springing up to claim the sunlight provided by unexpected break in the canopy. Once I reached the cedar thicket, I knew the road was only a few yards ahead of me. By this time, I had fished a small flashlight out of my pack. It wasn't much of a light, but would cast enough light to keep me from tripping over anything or rolling an ankle. When I reached the cedar trees, that's the first time I heard the high-pitched laughter coming from the ridge behind me. I wheeled around, scanning the woods with my flashlight, the beam only reaching a dozen yards or so. It was like no other sound I had heard. I had no explanation for it. My brain decided it was my father pulling a prank. That's what I told myself as I reached the road and started the uphill walk back to camp. That's when I heard it again, a high-pitched cackle, this time further up the ridge, 100 yards from where I had heard it last time. Way too far for someone to have walked in the time allowed. The idea of a prank quickly left my mind. Visions of devils and demons filled my brain. Blair Witch, maybe? At this point, the 30-30 was off my shoulder and in my right hand, feeble light still in my left, guiding my way. The high-pitched laughing cackle continued as I trudged up the hill, always changing locations, seeming to never be in the same place twice, always changing positions, always close, but never close enough for me to see the source of the noise. Every time it sounded, I got goosebumps on my body. My hair stood on end and I became more and more frightened. I jacked around into my 30-30 and continued to walk, a little faster pace this time. As the cackling continued, I picked up the pace and took the safety off my lever-action rifle. By the time I was nearing camp, I had the hammer geared back on my firearm and was almost jogging up the logging road, flashlight swinging back and forth, trying to spot the source of this menacing cackle. As I neared the top of the ridge, I started to feel safer as I saw the glow of the campfire surrounded by the headlamps of my father and his friends. The cackling laughter seemed to sense the presence of more seasoned men and started to lag behind, staying in the depths of the forest, not coming closer to the camp. Once in the light of the fire, I stopped to catch my breath and took the time to clear my firearm once again. The cackling laughter could barely be heard now, moving back into the forest, soon fading out to nothing. I acted as normal as I could, going about getting dinner, hanging out by the fire. It wasn't until I had my father alone later that evening that I told him what I had experienced. With a little sideways smirk and kindly hand on my shoulder, he explained everything I ever needed to know about barred owls and the variety of noises they can make. Except the fact that I can't understand why that owl was following me all the way through my walk.